Welcome to the Power of Attorney Project, which is part of our Conversations That Matter podcast. My name is Mary Bart, Chair of Caregiving Matters. This podcast is intended to provide general information only and is not intended to be a substitute for seeking personalized legal, financial, or other advice. This podcast raises issues that our audience can further explore on their own in their own local communities with their own local experts. This project will help to be a call to action for families to solve their issues, find solutions to their problems, and have greater peace of mind.
Today's podcast is called Acting Under a Continuing Powers of Attorney for Property. And our guest expert is lawyer Mary Ellis Thompson. Welcome, Mary Ellis.
Thank you. Would you like me to say a little about my background now?
That would be wonderful. Thank you.
I'm a lawyer in Ontario. I practice elder law, and I practice specifically estates and trusts law. I'm actually a certified specialist by the Law Society of Upper Canada in that area. And that means that as part of my practice, I prepare a lot of powers of attorney for property, and I advise people who are acting under the powers of attorney for property. And I see that a lot of people don't understand what their basic duties are under those documents.
Thank you for that. And just to let our audience know that our conversation today is going to be about Pat, who is acting for his mother under a continuing powers of attorney for property in Ontario. If you don't live in Ontario, please listen anyway, because this topic may be of interest to you to follow up with a lawyer in your own local area. So let's get started. My first question is, what are the obligations of Pat, who is acting for his mother under a continuing powers of attorney for property in Ontario?
Well, the first thing is, it depends on whether Pat's mother is or is not capable of making her own financial decisions. Often people think of powers of attorney for property as being used only when the person who gave the power of attorney, that's the person we'll call a donor or a grantor, only when that person is no longer capable of managing their finances. But in fact, powers of attorney, unless they are restricted in some way, can be used any time after they are executed. So it might be that Pat's mother in this case is perfectly well able to manage her own finances, and she's just asked Pat to give her some help in doing that. In that case, Pat's obligation is really to act as his mother's agent, to do what she tells him to. So she might tell him, go down and deposit this check in the bank. She might tell him, go talk to my broker and tell him I'd like to sell some of this stock. Those kinds of things he will do, but his obligation is to do what his mother directs him to do and to report to her. If, however, his mother is no longer able to make her own decisions, his obligations become more onerous. He has an obligation at that point to act as a fiduciary in her best interests. That means, first of all, that he has to exercise the care, skill, and diligence of a prudent person managing his or her own affairs. If he decides he wants to be paid, and we'll talk about that further on, the standard is higher. He actually has to act with the care, skill, and diligence of a person managing other people's affairs. Now, part of that is he has to keep careful accounts. He has to make sure that he's got the underlying documents to support those, but every transaction that he does on his mother's behalf, he should record somewhere so that he knows the date that it was made, what it was for, who he paid or who paid him. and the amount. And those accounts are set out in Ontario in the regulations under the governing legislation, which is the Substitute Decisions Act. In addition, he has to make sure that while he's managing, he's looking after his mother's comfort and well-being, that he's working with whoever is making decisions on behalf of her personal care, if that's not her. He needs to be explaining to her what he is doing and encouraging her to participate in the decisions that he makes. He needs to be trying to encourage contact between her and supportive family members and friends, and consulting supportive family members and friends, and also caregivers of his mother. So that's a lot that he has to do, and he should probably give thought to where he's going to keep his records, since he has to keep them well, and keeping a record of the discussions he has with any of the people that he's consulting.
That's very interesting. And your comment there about keeping records with people that he has conversations, so that could be even something as simple as saying, I had a conversation with the bank manager today, and here's what we talked about, and here's the date, and here's what we concluded through that meeting. That's the kind of thing you're speaking of.
Yes. So that isn't actually set out in the legislation, but it's a very wise thing for him to do, because down the road he may forget that he had that conversation with the bank manager. And if he is challenged on the decisions that he's made and the action that he's taken, it's very helpful to have that kind of record.
Thank you for that. Now, I have a second question for you. Can Pat make the annual donation to a charity? And can Pat help the grandchildren with their tuition?
Again, it makes a difference whether Pat's mother is or is not capable of making her own decisions. To go back to what I said at the beginning, if Pat's mother is capable, she's going to make the decisions about whether there's a donation to charity, and in that case, of course, Pat can do what his mother directs him to do, and similarly with helping grandchildren with their tuition. If, however, Pat's mother is no longer capable of making the decisions for herself, then we look to the document itself. So sometimes the continuing power of attorney for property, which is the term we use in Ontario for this document, will make statements about whether his mother wants gifts to be made on her behalf or not. And in that case, he's going to have to follow what's in that document. But if there's nothing in the document, the statute itself does provide some guidance on how he can decide about making gifts. And it does make a distinction between making gifts to family members and making gifts to charities. So if we're thinking about a charity first, he needs to make sure that the gift would have been authorized by his mother when she was capable, and that there's evidence that she made similar expenditures when she was capable. So if she's authorized it, for example, in the power of attorney itself, then that would be good enough. But if there was evidence, for example, that she gave $100 every year to the United Way, then that would be evidence that similar expenditures were made by her while she was capable. And that would make it acceptable for him to make those gifts. Now, there are some limits on that. With a charity, or with a gift to family, he can't make the gift if now mother is saying, I don't want you to pay anything to the United Way, in the example that we're using. Similarly, with the charitable gifts, there are limits on how much of mom's income he can use to make a charitable gift. And if he wants to go over those, he would have to make a court application. With respect to helping the grandchildren with their tuition, again, there may be something in the power of attorney that's going to be helpful. But if there isn't, we go back to the statute, and what does it say about making gifts? Well, again, there has to be reason to believe, based on what Mum expressed when she was capable, that she would have made them if she were capable. So that could be something in writing in the power of attorney itself, or it could be some other place where Mum said very clearly, preferably in writing, if my grandchildren need help with their education, I want to be able to do that. So there has to be an indication that this is the kind of thing that Mum would have wanted to do. Again, if Mum is now saying, no way, I don't want any money going for my grandchildren's tuition, that would put a brake on making the gifts for the tuition. There's also another concern here, and that is that Pat can't give away the money that Mum needs for herself. So there are no expenditures that can be made unless Mum's needs have been met, and the needs of any dependents, if Mum has dependents, and her legal obligations. So Pat can't think about making gifts to a charity or to grandchildren unless he's satisfied that what he has in hand, so Mum's assets, are going to be sufficient to meet her needs, the needs of her dependents, and her other legal obligations. I should have mentioned in connection with Pat's obligations that one of the things he has to do is familiarize himself with Mum's assets. When he begins to act under that power of attorney for property, he has to find out what Mum owns, and he has to make sure that he's in a position to control it, make sure it's protected, insured. In other words, he has to guard that property and make sure that it's kept in good condition. Similarly, he has to find out whether Mum has a will and what's in the will, because he can't be giving away things that are dealt with specifically in the will, except in very certain circumstances.
And just to add a note to that about taking care of the assets, I believe it is a lot of homework in some cases for people to find all the assets and to find all the bank accounts and maybe savings bonds or insurance policies. So the person has a bit of homework to get it all organized, and that takes some time and some patience.
It does. This is not an easy job, and sometimes people think that, you know, it's a great honor to be appointed as an attorney under a power of attorney for property, and that's as far as they go. In fact, it can involve a lot of work, so anyone who's going to undertake the job needs to be aware of that.
Thank you for that. And to go on to our next question, can Pat sell the house and distribute the proceeds to the children?
Well, there's two parts to that question, and I'd like to deal with the selling and the distributing as separate issues. So as far as selling the house, I mentioned that Pat has to look at his mother's will and find out what's in it, because supposing the will actually makes a gift of the house to a specific person, well, that's a problem if the house is going to be sold. And the Substitute Decision Act does actually say that Pat is not to sell the house if he knows that it's subject to a gift in the will. Now, there are some exceptions to that, and the first is that if he needs to sell the house because there are no funds for Mum's living expenses unless and until the house is sold, then that might be a reason to sell it. The other instance in which he might consider selling it or, in fact, gifting it is if the gift falls within the general guidelines for gifting generally, and there is a person in the will who is named as the recipient of the house. So if the house was of proportionately small value and it was gifted to someone, he could make that gift now. But as far as selling it, and I guess I should have said this in the beginning, he shouldn't sell it if mom is living there. So I think we're assuming here that mom is moving or has moved to some other sort of a facility. And of course, all of this is subject to the assumption that mom is incapable, because if mom is capable, again, he does what mom would tell him to in those circumstances. Now, as to distributing the proceeds to the children, again, if we go back to the discussion about gifting, the question is going to be, first of all, is this something that mom would have done and that Pat knows she would have done based on intentions that she expressed while she was capable? That's the first thing. The second thing is it contrary to her wishes now? So she has to have indicated when she was capable, oh yes, when my house is sold, I definitely want the money from that sale distributed to my kids. And she also has to be now willing for that to happen, even if she's not capable. If she's saying, no, no, I don't want the money from my house distributed to the kids, then that's a problem for Pat to do that. And of course, the money, if the house is being sold because mom needs the money to live on, it can't be distributed to the kids.
Thank you for that. And our next question is, can Pat take money to make up for his time and expenses?
There's two parts to this, making up for his time and making up for his expenses. So we make a distinction between the money that Pat is actually out of pocket and the money that he might be paid for his time and trouble in looking after mom's affairs. So let's deal with the expenses, the money that he might actually be out of pocket. Say he is helping mom move from her house to her new residence, and he actually puts the cost of the mover on his visa bill. Yes, he can reimburse himself for that money that he spent on mom's behalf, and that's a legitimate expense. And as long, again, as he documents it, keeps it in his records, you know, what he spent on what day, what the purpose was, and what the amount was, he can do that. The question of compensation for his time and trouble, however, is different. And this is set out, again, in the regulations. There are regulations under the Act, and they say how a person is entitled to be paid if they're acting under a power of attorney for property. They can be paid 3% of the capital and income receipts. So if you think about Pat managing money for mother, and he is collecting her pension and her RIFs and so forth, those are the receipts. He sells the house, and the value of the house gets deposited into a bank account that he's managing. That's a capital receipt. He can take 3% on the value of each of those transactions. Similarly, 3% on capital and income disbursements. So if he's paying for her rent in her new facility, if he's paying for clothing, he's paying utilities on her behalf. So what he's disbursing, he's entitled to take 3% of that. In addition, he can take 0.75% on the average annual value of the assets that he is looking after. So the total value of mom's assets that he's managing, he can take 0.75% of that every year. Now, a couple of things about this. If he does that, he raises the standard that he's going to be held to. You remember that I said that the standard for Pat, when he's acting in these circumstances, is the standard of a prudent person managing his or her own affairs. If Pat decides that he is going to be paid and he takes that compensation, he's going to be held to a higher standard. It's the standard that a professional trustee would be expected to meet, and that's the standard of a person in the business of managing other people's money and affairs. So Pat may want to take compensation, but he should be aware that if he does that, the standard for his behavior goes up. The second thing is, if Pat is going to take compensation, he may well want to consider going through a process known as passing of accounts. That's a process where the court can look at his accounts and approve the compensation that he's taking. It's something that people sometimes are shy of doing because they don't like the idea of going to court. But what it does is give Pat the comfort of knowing that the compensation that he has taken is in fact appropriate and approved by the courts.
I have a related question to that that I just thought of. So if Pat takes compensation, does he have to report that as income when he does his annual filing to the CRA?
Yes, he does. And he has to pay tax on it and he has to pay CPP on it.
Thank you.
That's income because it is work that he is doing and being paid for.
Thank you for that. That's very interesting. My next question is, can Pat show the other adult children the accounts and financial information?
This is a difficult one because the accounts that he's preparing for mother, again, let me go back. If his mother is still capable, then and she consents to having the children shown the accounts, then he can do it. He's simply acting on her directions. If, however, his mother is incapable, we go back to the fact that he is a fiduciary. His mother still has privacy rights, and these accounts are confidential. So if he shows them to the other children, he may well be breaching his obligation to his mother to keep her financial affairs confidential. On the other hand, if he decides that he wants to pass his accounts, or if he doesn't pass his accounts and eventually the executor, which may be him or maybe somebody else under his mother's estate, wants to challenge what he has done, all of that information is going to be made available to the other children. So he may feel at that point that it was better if he could have shown them what he was doing and got their consent to what he was doing. Now, he can get consent for particular actions. You remember that I said he consults with supportive family and friends, but to show the complete accounts and financial information is probably a breach of his mother's confidentiality.
That's very interesting. Thank you for that. And my final question for you is, can Pat take some steps to reduce the probate on his mother's estate?
He can, but he may not be able to do as much as he thinks he can. So, for example, using the power of attorney, and again, I need to say I'm assuming here that we're talking about a situation where the mother is no longer capable. If mother is capable, he acts under her direction and he can do essentially what she tells him to. But if the mother is incapable and he's thinking, well, you know, there's these assets, let's see if there isn't some way that we can keep them out of the estate and not pay probate on them. It may depend on the kind of planning that he plans to do, and it may depend on what is actually in the continuing power of attorney itself. So, a continuing power of attorney for property may or may not give him some support in making a series of transactions, but there are also some transactions that he probably can't do at all. That's because the Substitute Decisions Act says that a person acting under a continuing power of attorney for property can do anything with that person's property that the person themselves could do except make a will. So Pat can do anything with Mum's assets that she could do except make a will. What that has been interpreted as meaning is not just that Pat can't sit down and write a will for Mother, but that there are some transactions that are like enough to making a will because they have effect only when the person dies, they transfer assets and so forth, that a person acting under a power of attorney for property can't do those things either. For example, a person acting under a power of attorney for property will not be able to designate a beneficiary on a registered plan. So if, for example, Pat's mother has a registered retirement income fund, and the original beneficiary on that was his mother's spouse. Let's say that's Pat's dad, but dad has predeceased. What's going to happen by default is those funds would be payable into the estate. Pat may think, well, why can't I just change the designation on that using my power of attorney? I'll go down to the bank and I'll say, let's have that payable to me and my two sisters. We're all of the children. That's where it's going to go under Mum's will anyway, and we'll save the probate. The problem is the bank will refuse to recognize his power of attorney for that purpose because that is a will-making-like act when he changes or attempts to make a beneficiary designation on a registered plan. Some other things that Pat might think about doing are putting assets into joint names with his mother. And again, he probably has the legal power to do this. So he could, if he's decided he can't dispose of the house at this point, or, you know, say Mom is still living in the house, they've arranged to get care for her and she is able to stay there, he might say, well, why can't I put that house joint between Mom and me? I'm going to be her executor. I know what she wants to do with it, and that way we won't have to pay probate on the house. The difficulty is, first of all, once Pat is named on the house, that may have other repercussions. So it may give Pat's spouse, Pat's creditors, and so forth, an interest in the house, and that might be problematic. It may also have repercussions as far as the status of the house as a principal residence. If Mum is living there, it's her principal residence, but if Pat is not living there, it's not his principal residence. So we're going to assume that the intention in that case is for Pat to treat it as part of the estate. What will happen is that when Mum dies and there has to be a statement made to the court about Mum's assets, the house is likely going to have to be listed anyway because the intention was for it to be part of the estate. And so the attempt to remove the house from probate will have failed, but will also have entailed some cost and some complications and possibly also some unhappiness in the family if Pat's sisters are aware of what's going on. So that, again, although Pat can do it legally, it may actually not be a very wise thing to do, and it may, in fact, not be effective to reduce the probate on his mother's estate. Pat might also look at trying to change life insurance designations. He will have the same problem there that he has with registered plans. That is seen as being a will-making kind of a change, and his attempt to use the power of attorney to make that change is not likely to be recognized. One other thing that Pat might consider trying to do is set up an inter vivos trust. So if mom is living alone, if she's over 65, and if she otherwise meets the requirements for what's known as an alter ego trust, Pat may think, well, let's move some of mom's assets into an alter ego trust, because the assets that are in the trust will not belong to mom at the time of her death, and therefore they will not be subject to probate. And it does appear that that's something Pat can use his power of attorney to do. If he decides he wants to do that, however, he needs to be extremely careful about how he does it and what the wording in the trust is, and it is very important that he be well advised both from a legal and a tax perspective.
You bring up so many interesting points, and as a layperson, it really makes me encourage people to go and seek legal advice and ask the questions that you're helping us answer, because it is complicated and it is complex. And one of the goals of this project is to say, you know what, these are really, really important issues. And I encourage people to not try and solve these on their own, that there are experts who can help guide and help set suggestions of what could happen. And so for people listening to this, the message really is to go and find a lawyer and an accountant in your area and have these conversations so that you are more knowledgeable about the options and the benefits and risks of many of your ideas. So thank you for sharing all of that. And to wrap up,
welcome.
I would like to take this opportunity to thank you, Mary Alice, for joining our project, for sharing your wisdom, and helping people to understand that it is a complicated and very important role. And I often say, it is probably one of the most important roles we will play in our families' lives. So thank you. Thank you so much for that.
You're most welcome. May I say also that there is information available on our website, which is at www.cswan.com, on acting on a power of attorney for property or acting on a power of attorney for personal care.
Thank you for that. And do you have any other contact information to share?
I can be found on that website, www.cswan.com, and all of my contact information is there.
Perfect. Thank you. And now, to wrap up this conversation, Chris Cata, who is one of our board of directors, and I have a few closing comments.
Mary, who are our initial project supporters?
We wish to acknowledge that this project is funded in part by the Government of Canada's New Horizons for Seniors program. Our other initial supporters include Care Connect, the Care Guide, the Healing Cycle Foundation, and Scotia Trust. Caregiving Matters is an internet-based registered Canadian charity dedicated to educating and supporting family caregivers. 90% of our work is done online and by leveraging technologies. 10% is done by producing local educational events. We leverage technologies in everything that we do, ensuring greater reach and sustainability. I trust that we have given you some of the highlights of our exciting new initiative. If you are interested in speaking with me about the project, please let me know. We look forward to your questions and your ideas.
Mary, if listeners have questions, what's the best way for them to contact us?
Well, they can contact me, Mary Bart, Chair of Caregiving Matters. My email is mary@caregivingmatters.ca. Our telephone number is 905-939-2931, and our website is www.caregivingmatters.ca.